What is up, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce you to this week's episode. Matt Odell and I sat down with Rodolfo Novak from CoinKite and had an incredible conversation while we were at the BitBlock Boom conference. Rodolfo is an incredible person who I was very pumped to meet for the first time while we were at that conference. We had an incredible conversation, far-ranging. Talked about the history of CoinKite, the iterations it's gone through, ham radios, and airplanes. It was a fun one. This week's episode is brought to you by the Cash App. You freaks already know all about them. And if you don't, here's some info. You know, the Cash App, they're helping you stack sats. They're helping you save money at merchants. And they do this in a really cool way. So you can buy and sell Bitcoin on the Cash App. On top of that, you can withdraw your coins to a personal wallet, not your keys, not your coins. And then you can send Bitcoin to your Cash App wallet when you need to, if you have to dump sats, which we never like to do, but sometimes people have to do that. You can do that on the Cash App, sending from a personal wallet to the Cash App. On top of that, their Boost program, you're going to get a personalized Boost card. You do it up with your signature. You make it all cool. You can put a little Bitcoin sign, a little lightning bolt, whatever fancies you, whatever tickles your fancy. There we go. That's what I should have said. And yeah, so use the code STACKINGSATS when you're downloading the app. If you haven't already, you're going to get $5, and then $5 is going to go to Owls Across, an incredible charity that's based out of Chicago, helping young boys and girls learn leadership skills through the sport of lacrosse. So again, stacking sats, you're going to get $5. Al's is going to get $5. Download the Cash App today. And guess what, freaks? We got a new sponsor on board with TFTC. Pumped to have these guys on. Casa, you already know all about them if you've been listening to this podcast for a while. We've had Jeremy Welch on before. Matt and I talk about their node setup and what they're doing a lot on RHR. And now they're officially on board. So how confident are you in your security? What keeps you up at night with your personal ops sec? Our friends at Casa have drummed up one of the smartest, most secure ways to hodl your Bitcoin. No KYC, no altcoins, no percentage fees on your Bitcoin. No one standing between you and your keys. From Jamison Lopp and one of the most trusted teams in Bitcoin security, including the co-creator of the Glacier Protocol and Elena Vernova, founder of Trezor, comes peace of mind with your stash. With the world's secure, one of the world's most secure multi-sigs. Use the promo code TFTC to get up to $250 off your Casa membership, or hit their team up, membership at team.casa for a free demo, or to put them to the test with your hardest OPSEC questions. Let them know that we sent you. Tell them that you heard about them on TFTC, and you're here to learn more. You're going to get up to $250 off. Again, that's membership at team.casa. If you want to email them directly, if you just want to check out the product, you can go to keys.casa and check out their whole process, what they're doing. Full suite, they have packages, all memberships come with a full set of hardware wallets for your multi-sig, plus the Casa node, Faraday bags, early access to future Casa products, and even for you serious hodlers who are thinking very long-term, very low time preference, they have diamond and platinum membership levels that net you 24/7 VIP service, dedicated client advisor, and custom onboarding and OPSEC plan. They're going to walk you through all that. So again, shout out to Casa. Use the promo code TFTC or let them know that we sent you at membership@team.casa, and you're going to get up to $250 off your Casa membership. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I know Matt and I had an incredible time sitting down with Rodolfo. What a legend. Do we need a TikTok?
No, we do not need a TikTok.
Are we getting a Twitch?
We definitely need a Twitch, though.
I haven't gamed in a while. Are you?
I can't play games, man. You know, I suck at even solitary.
I would be down for a Twitch just to shoot the shit with the streamers. Or not the streamers, the people watching the stream.
We need to get a young gun. Otherwise, we're screwed.
We're not young guns anymore?
No, we're old timers in terms of video games.
Andrew Chow is on. Is doing Twitch now. Like, he's doing a code review or whatever on Twitch for,
really?
For Bitcoin Core. Yeah, I don't know how long that's gonna last, but
that's actually a good medium to do it by. Because what, John Newberry is doing it in IRC, correct?
Yes.
For you freaks out there, we just hit record because we're having a fun conversation. Matt Odell and I are in Dallas, sitting down with Rodolfo Novak from Cold Card, What is the overarching company?
CoinKite.
CoinKite, right?
CoinKite, that's right. Yeah, that's the master umbrella corporation.
Yes, CoinKite is the master umbrella corporation. Created OpenDime, which is great for Nature's Pocket. Cold Card, which is great for your cold storage. And we've been having a fun time here in Dallas. We shut down the bar last night. How are you feeling?
I hope I will speed up my brain again. the Southern folks here are very nice. Everybody was very kind. And we were fed and given a lot of booze.
I didn't wind up eating last night.
Yeah, you didn't eat that much. You like came over and you only ate because Rodolfo ordered more meat.
Thank you for ordering more meat.
Oh, man. I was like still like hungry.
I still haven't eaten. I'm starving.
I'm ready for lunch.
Intermittent fasting. It's a lifestyle. yeah, so we just hit record. We're rolling into this. This is Tales from the Crypt. I guess we should get serious here. Rodolfo, how did you come to find Bitcoin? You're creating all this dope hardware. You're contributing to the space, both with hardware and with memeware. How did you find Bitcoin? What drew you towards it? And yeah, let's start there.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching congressional hearings and I heard about Bitcoin. And no, I'm kidding. I think it was Peter Bumpin. No. In 2010, the Slashdot article, which I really regret not saying something very stupid on the comments because they closed down that thread. Like, and it took a while for them to close that thread. But, yeah, it was interesting thing. Kind of did not really think it was probably going to work just because of the scale that you need to get to for that thing to work. And but to me, the main moment was when I made a first transaction. I was like, fuck.
Like, when was that? What were you doing?
No, it was just sending between like me and yourself. Peter. Like we bought some and we were just sending around and we were like, seriously, like, holy shit. Like I can literally send money from my computer and the money is in the computer.
It's like, files are in the computer.
Zoolander.
Yeah, like it's like it's in the computer, you know, for kids that can't read good. Right. But it's like. It's a paradigm shift. I mean, like, never before the money was in the computer. I mean, it was in the bank, balance sheets and all that stuff, or it was the gold on your desk. And then every time you wanted to send money on through the computer, somebody was clearing that or sort of being a middleman on that. Like, it was literally impossible to send money digitally.
But with Bitcoin, it's like a digital bearer asset. It's the first, like, yeah, actual digital bearer asset we've ever had.
So when I saw the value there, like, it's just I couldn't stop sort of like thinking about this stuff.
And what were you doing before?
I at that time I think I was working in the startup where we were making a time series data search engine. I had some other businesses going on and we were making some iPhone apps on the side, and I'm just always doing a bunch of stuff.
And so you found Bitcoin. Did you drop everything right away, or did it take you some time to dive in?
No, it was like I kind of carried that on the side. And then we built a BTClook.com. By the way, the block data, all the block data was about like, I think, 4 or 8 gigabytes at a time. So we built this very cool block explorer that had like bubbles and stuff. And like, it was like the whole block data was in RAM, so like it was Redis on a single computer, you know, and it could transverse the whole thing. It was pretty awesome. We closed that project once we couldn't fit in like affordable RAM server. So we built that to sort of try to understand Bitcoin, right? Like the best way to understand Bitcoin is to build a block explorer.
What do you learn when you're building a block explorer?
You start just understanding the concept of like,
it's a little closer.
You try to understand like the concept of like, you know, the UTXOs and sort of like how this whole thing actually works. And then we're like, okay, this is cool. It's money, so let's make payment terminals. And that was a little bit early. And so in 2013, we launched the Bitcoin payment terminals
through CoinKite, right?
Through CoinKite, exactly. And we made the first Bitcoin debit cards. I actually have one here.
And you had like there was a wallet service there too, right?
Yeah. So have you guys seen this? Like, there was
not in a while.
So we made the debit machines, but we couldn't trust really the wallets that were around. Like, blockchain.info was garbage. And
why is the shitcoin on the back?
So back in the day, like, there was no real alternative to doing like a faster settlement unless you accepted zero conf, right? There was no sort of solution yet, and malleability was real. So I actually thought that Litecoin was the fairly reasonable solution for faster confirmations for sort of like retail.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use, you know, Bitcoin to actually do real settlements, but you could use like Litecoin for little
coffee
stuff. Yeah. So then we couldn't trust the wallet, so we built CoinKite.com as an actual wallet, and then we built the multi-sig stuff, and then all that stuff that came after that.
What I thought was interesting about the CoinKite wallet wasn't the business model, it was a percentage fee, right, you charged?
Yeah, so when we launched, we were charging, I think, 3%.
Remaking the credit card?
Exactly. No, but, like, you know, that's, like, how, like, silly my understandings of the economics of a company like that were, right? Like, I mean, once you kind of get into it, you understand the kind of cost that a payment sort of processor manager, like, that. It's very expensive to maintain money safe and to actually help people do this stuff. And, you know, users don't like to pay for anything. So, but surprisingly enough, we got a lot of users paying us 3% for like a little while. And then we kept on dropping the fee, right? Like every month we would drop the fee to see if we get more users, and we would. So we ended up changing the complete business model from like percentage to then like just monthly fees kind of thing. And like, standard bank, right? Like, you pay them to keep your money safe. And we had the multi-sig stuff, which makes it harder for us to take our percentage to because they could just not give us.
And so it's interesting, like, you're learning about the economics of these systems on the way. So you were talking about like it's money in the computer earlier, but like, were you fascinated by money before Bitcoin economics? Or did you sort of come to understand the economics
after?
No,
I came from the tech side.
Mm-hmm.
I learned economics later. the arts degree did not give me a very good economical education.
And so keeping in line with like the story of CoinKite, like the iterations you with the card. And so how did that lead to OpenDime? Like what moved you to hardware from cards?
So we got to a point that we were holding like a lot of Bitcoin. A lot, and we were fairly quiet in those days, like in social media and stuff, because, you know, we were kind of scared of like publicizing too much, security concerns, right? And we sort of like decided to close it. I'm like, this is not what I want to do in my life. I don't want to hold people's bags. It's a pain in the ass. And we closed it down, dispersed all the funds within like, I think, 3-4 weeks. And then I'm like, okay, let's just go back to hardware, just do hardware, because we had built the HSMs to run CoinKite.
For the actual terminal thing too, right?
Yes, we built the terminals too. We essentially, every time we sort of like come up with something, we build the thing to support it.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to build the complete opposite of CoinKite.com, like the literal opposite. And OpenDime is the ultimate point solution as opposed to, you know, a connected solution, right? So it took us a little while. We played with like metal bars, we played with like aluminum folding things and paper and all kinds of stuff, and like, but we couldn't, like, until sort of we sorted out that, you know, no, like the user doesn't know the private key, and we need a safe way of doing that, and we also need to appease all the cypherpunks were going to say that we know the private key. So we figured out, hey, you know, let's get the user to initiate the device, give some entropy from themselves into the device, and then we can prove that we don't know the private key. And the user can prove that he doesn't know the private key. And the receiver can verify all that too. And that's sort of like, that's how OpenDime happened.
Let's unpack this a little bit, because I think it's pretty cool how you do the OpenDime entropy. So the idea is that you basically drag a file onto the OpenDime, and then that's used as the entropy, like a user-provided file, right?
Exactly.
So it's just random data. Correct?
It's just random data.
Okay.
But because, you know, in that sort of mindset of doing the complete opposite of what we're doing before, it's like, we never want to support an app, a website, or like API ever again. we don't want to build apps, period. And
so OpenDime was birthed out of laziness almost?
Pretty much. Like all good things, right?
You shouldn't say laziness.
Well, I think it's interesting because like CoinKite, you guys have basically, you went through the same process that almost everyone who enters Bitcoin goes through, right? Which is like, oh, this is cool. Like merchants should use this. This is going to be like a merchant processing thing. Oh no, the business model here is to hold people's Bitcoin for them, right? And then you realize there's not really much money to be made. There's a fucking headache. And then you come all the way full circle to user controls their own keys. We just make the hardware for them and we don't have to touch any of that.
Exactly. Bitcoin hates on middlemen. So trying to be a middleman in Bitcoin, you're going to have to pay it somehow, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're either going to pay through security concerns, and then there's all the costs around that. It's very tricky. And everybody eventually finds that out. Unless you're an institution, right? So if you're talking about institutional holdings for Bitcoin, now you want to defer the liability to somebody else, right? Because you need to cover your ass.
Mm-hmm.
That's with like investment funds, whatever it will do, they will find some other company to hold the bag and put insurance on it so that they can tell their board, look, you know, it's all insured.
We check the boxes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so obviously this is complete opposite of what you're pushing with the hardware, where users take control of their own keys. And what's fascinating to me about the hardware that you've produced is just how transparent and open it is. And that's actually a topic that we talk about a lot on Rabbit Hole Recap, is the fickleness of hardware wallets in particular. And you can give advice on a hardware wallet one day, and then 6 months later, it's bad advice. And so how does that factor into what you guys are building?
So, I mean, so we closed down CoinKite. We needed something for ourselves, right? And I was fairly unsatisfied. I think it's the best, most polite way to put it, about the current available solutions. Because, you know, we do have a background in hardware, so we sort of understood like what was missing and what we wanted to do. So we made it. So we made CodeCard, which sort of sits, it solves a bit of that problem. Like, so security is always a set of trade-offs, right? And hardware, you also have the trade-off in terms of being able to manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just come up with some idea for an app and make it, right? Like, you also need to find the economics to manufacture it. You need to make sure the parts that you want are available to you. And so yeah, it's fairly tricky, right?
It's like a puzzle you have to put together, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, there was one solution that sort of like was open source, the fairly old one. And, but you know, there's no physical security whatsoever on it. And I noticed the shift in their marketing, which used to be secure, to now is sort of like, oh, there's no such thing as security.
We're talking about the Trezor, right?
I'm not going to name competitors. Everybody knows which wallets are what. And then the other one, it's like, you know, those guys are actually pros. You know, maybe their software is not like what people love, but, you know, the actual hardware is fairly safe. It's fairly good. And it's a very old way of doing security. Right, you have a secure element, and you put all the stuff in it. But the problem is, it needs to be closed source, because those vendors are not going to let you open source it.
Yes. So let's expound upon the secure enclave. Like, what is it exactly? How does it work
so
in the device?
Imagine like this, right? So you have a standard MCU, like one of them. And this MCU was just designed to sort of like, you know, work on your toaster, you know, work your microwave, you know, do things like that. I mean, nowadays, we're sort of starting to care about security in these things, but, you know, these chips were not designed to do any security, right? So you can peel it very easily. You can throw radio at it and make it do things that it's not supposed to, which is one of the attacks. You can read its power to read its calculations. So the thing essentially is just sort of like not designed to keep anything safe. And then a secure enclave or secure element, what it does is it has like, say, you have like layers, actual physical layers on it that prevent you from doing attacks of peeling very easily. Anything is doable, but the cost to attack that is substantially higher, and you can destroy it in the process too. So you protect the power reading, so you can't, so it doesn't leak memory. It doesn't leak any calculations through the power. You have like monotonic counters. These are essentially one-way counters. They're verifiable. And it's pretty cool because, for example, when you do your math for pin attempts, for example, right? Like, you can't cheat that because it's inside the monotonic counter. And that's how you keep the data safe. And then you will you prevent you from doing the radio stuff on it. Not everything, but some of it. Point is, it's designed to do this stuff. Now, the problem is they also have closed source, for example, crypto accelerators, right? That means you don't have to actually like use a function, like a code function, to say do a cryptographic calculation. You use the actual hardware that already has the curve in it, and it'll do for you, right? I don't believe any secure element at the moment have a Bitcoin curve on them. But you can use those for other kinds of encryptions that you would do in a device like that. But the problem is, when you do Bitcoin, you really want the code that does Bitcoin calculations to be open, right? Other parts of it, not as important. So essentially, in Bitcoin, we were presented with these two options, right? The fully closed, the fully open. They both extreme sets of trade-offs, right? So we decided to sort of build something in the middle. What we did was we used a general-purpose MCU that's not designed for security, even though ours has a firewall on it. I wouldn't trust it for my life. To do the open sort of calculations that we need, right? And then we use a very dumb but very secure element just to keep seed secure. It also comes with a TRNG, which is a true random number generator that's verified by, say, NIST kind of thing. So you get those features for free, and we don't use any of its crypto to do Bitcoin stuff.
So it's separated.
Exactly. It's separate. Mm-hmm. However, we did convince the manufacturer to let us put the spec out of that chip, and the firmware that we load on that chip is also open source.
Okay.
And there is, by the way, there is no such thing as open source chips. That's a BS marketing. Essentially, all the chips you buy are closed source. It's just that you can show that the code you're running on those chips is open source. There is a few projects out there trying to do open source micros and stuff, but in my opinion, it's hopeless. Just the patent stuff. Patenting hardware is a real thing, right? Like, software, people get more away with stuff, but good luck trying to break those patents or to do stuff around it. And it also costs, right? To make a micro would cost, you know, depending on, like, something simple that's not even secure, you know, would cost you, you know, $10 million. And then, what, you're still going to end up with something that all the same people use, so now you don't have any diversity. You know, it's a problem.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating problem, and one that, specifically speaking of hardware wallets and leaking data and their security in particular, it's. Do you think it's close to being solved at all, or will ever be solved, or?
No, it'll never be solved because security is always going to be a set of trade-offs,
mm-hmm.
And I think we can still improve the UX on like Bitcoin security substantially, but you know, it's possible that some of these manufacturers would eventually do chips that can do a little bit better for Bitcoin for our needs.
I mean, multi-sig's interesting here, right? Because you can combine hardware that takes different trade-offs.
Yes.
And you kind of cover your ass in all the different, in most of the different threat vectors, right?
Yeah, so multi-sig is tricky. I think the issue, like one of the main issues with Bitcoin security is that most people screw themselves out of their money than getting hacked. So every time you increase complexity on something that, like, you know, sort of your last resort thing or whatever, it gets it's very dangerous. Like, you can lose your money because you don't have the redeem script. Because multisig now, it's essentially, I guess the simplest way you could say is, like, it's kind of like, it's not Bitcoin anymore. It's like you're creating extra complexity on the Bitcoin signing of that. And then you're just telling the network that you signed the transaction, right? And it's valid. But the scripts for the multisig setup are very very custom. I mean, they're made by the people who made the wallet, right? And those, there's no standards on that. I mean, there's some, but it's not like something that, you know. So people can screw themselves that way. So every time you're making your multisig setup, make sure you also have a backup of your redeem script. Otherwise, you're screwed.
It's very good advice.
And now imagine, like, you die, right? And then your family has, you know, this box under, you know, some mountain. You know, they take it out. It's like, you know, my crazy cuckoo, you know, husband left me this box with, like, these devices that all look ridiculous.
What are all these calculators doing?
Exactly, right? And, like, how do I redeem this stuff? Or, like, how do I take the money out? And then you're going to have to, what, use a consultant that might rob you? You know, like, it gets very tricky. So simplicity goes a long way. I think that you should only increase the complexity of your setup as you learn enough to do it. Right, so, like, go as far as you personally can and feel comfortable, and then slowly increase that. Right, it's not just like a smart person goes on some podcast or whatever and sort of, like, says, "Oh, dude, you know, like, there's all these problems. You know, maybe you should, you know, use it this way or that way." That's great, but that person has extreme understanding of
the trade-offs and the setup. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's that's why I love having Matt Odell as a co-host here, because he helps handhold me through this stuff. He's you're definitely more adept at setting this stuff up than I am. And but it is, like, again, like, going back to the fact of trying to educate people about this stuff. It is hard. It's like
it's super
so
intimidating.
It is very intimidating.
Yeah.
I get anxious almost.
Yeah. No. It's this stuff is not easy. Like, I mean, and, you know, like, it's, there's a reason why, you know, Ethereum devs build JavaScript crap. you know what I mean? Because, like, that's easy. You know, like, building hardware stuff and, like, actually working through these problems, it's not easy.
So what's the brainstorming of coming up with these solutions? Like, are you, like, whiteboarding it, or are you just, like, deep in thought in the
woods?
You
know, we have our Scrum morning meetings. You know, no. No, we normally just sort of, like, you know, we either meet, like, downtown or, like, in Toronto, or, like, because we both work from home. And we normally just Skype or whatever. And, you know, we chat about things we want to make. We have, like, piles and piles of ideas. And we have, like, we write them down, like, in this document. We just keep on listing them. And, like, sometimes we sort of investigate them slightly more, like, further to see if they're, like, economically viable. Because it'd be harder. Like, you have to think, like, okay, how much is this going to cost? How much is it going to cost to make? And then, like, what are the hidden costs in this? You know, shipping of that and all that stuff. but oftentimes, we actually make the stuff, at least one-offs kind of thing. So, like, I have, like, boxes in my basement of, like, crap we played with or tried to do.
So, like, how many iterations have
it
you
It depends. I mean, like, OpenDime, like, we had a lot of iterations. It's kind of funny, but the first version of the OpenDime was actually something that more resembles the code card.
Really?
Yeah. We had a screen on it. We had a QR camera on it. It was going to be sort of this more hardware wallet thing, but then we sort of gave up that for a while and then sort of became what it is. Yeah, I mean, it's you go through a lot of iterations until you sort of sort out the, especially for the manufacturing.
And when you have epiphanies about like what's going to work and what's not, like how does that happen? Is it happen through use, or are you like somewhere random and you're like, ah, this is what I need to do?
Yeah, it's and oftentimes it's really solving your own problems. It's like, God damn it, I can't do this. Okay, can we make this?
So, I mean, I think that the Cold Card is the best wallet on the market right now. I think it was an absolute game changer. It was a huge step improvement from, like, the existing hardware wallets. But nothing's perfect, right? Cool. So, as the creator of the Cold Card wallet, what do you think are the major weaknesses that it has right now?
So, there is a known attack vector that a security researcher exploited. We wrote a blog post about it in the first version. We improved the, so we made it much harder for him to get to the secure element bus. So essentially what you could do is you could try to ROM dump the MCU and then unencrypt some stuff and then take the pairing secret that you need to talk to the secure element, and then you can desolder the secure element out. Put it in a little rig that reads those, but you could break it in the process of doing that too. And then once you do that, you can try to brute force the pin. But now we have a better bus there, so we can't attach wires to it. And we also cover now the secure element with epoxy on this version.
Okay.
So the thing is, there is, even with a secure element, like the ultimate sort of secure element, right? There is still, like, the time is ticking if somebody has physical control of it, right? So I'd say, like, you know, 1 week, it's pretty doable with most secure elements. You can send to the right facility. They'll peel it. They'll do whatever. You know, done. Mm-hmm. Now, with the next version of Cold Card, We're upgrading the SCE, the secure element, to the next version of it. We plan on storing the stuff inside the SCE encrypted as well, because there's going to be more room. So even if you dump that, you're not going to be able to know what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea with security is always security in depth, right? Like, so you keep on making the attacker spend more money, mm-hmm. right? So we make the money bags. That's what the bag that the Cold Card comes in. You know, it costs for them to make a fake bag, mm-hmm. right? And then we add the serial number. So the serial number is also in the bag and inside the secure element, so they can't just use any bag, mm-hmm. right? And then we use the clear cases. And the case, you can actually inspect the device. And then the case is also sealed, so you'd have to break the case to change something inside. And then on top of that, we do the you have the two words in between, the first part of the pin and the second part of the pin. So somebody did manage to do a fairly advanced attack to replace, try to fish your pin out.
It wouldn't even have to be that advanced, right? They could just switch the device.
Exactly, right? But they'd have to make one that would look fairly similar, right? And then the retrieval of that information is hard, too. It'd have to have radio on it or something. But then, you know, you stop because the pin is going to show you the words. It's not there. This is fairly old anti-phishing tactic, right? Like, remember, like, some banks used to actually put a picture that you have to recognize before you put your password
yes.
and stuff?
Yes, yep.
So
mine was an Apple.
Yep. And then you can load your own firmware, and you blast it, you sign it with your PIN. So, you know, keep on increasing the cost, and making the competition sweat is fun, too.
Yeah. No, that, and then, like, there's also, like, weird ways through which your privacy and security can be compromise. And like the original Cold Card, right, it was like the buttons, like you could see if you're putting your pin in and like the buttons were wearing down, you'd be able to sort of be like, yep. All right, these four numbers are part of the pin, it's some combination of this. And it's like something that maybe most people don't think about, but it's like the small things like that factor yep. into this.
It's you know, there's no perfect solution, right? And at the end of the day, somebody can sort of still put a gun to your head and say, give it to me,
exactly, just hand it over.
And that's when you use your brick me pin and you say, I don't have it anymore. Shoot me.
I went boating last week, dude. You caught me at a bad time. That's, so this is a question I have. Like,
I don't, like, this is a well-known fact on this show, I don't like moving Bitcoin at all.
That's the best sort of solution for it.
Right?
Just don't move it.
Right? But, so what would you recommend? Like, as you're putting out newer iterations of the cold card and newer versions, do you recommend people move their storage to new stuff?
So the way we do it is you don't have to move the coins, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just move the seed.
Yeah.
We actually preferably use the encrypted backup solution and then, you know, restore.
Yeah, just wipe your current
SD card.
Exactly.
Wipe your current device.
Exactly. No, you put your tin foil hat properly, your tin foil outfit, tin foil underwear, you know.
You get in your Faraday cage.
If your Faraday tent, you know, you can buy those. And, you transfer the seed from one to the other. And then, you know, you take your old cold card to the range and you show a good time.
So you do recommend as new cold cards come out, people port their seeds to the new one.
Yeah. Like, and the thing is, I find that like around the $100 price point, right? It's fairly like reasonable for you to sort of upgrade to the newest and greatest, because, you know, you're trying to hold like substantial money, and, you know, like just look at your banking fees. I mean, like, you know, like how much a bank takes from you to do this stuff. And then you have this little device that costs $100 that you have your wealth on, you know, like it's like, yeah, upgrade it, you know. And also by buying stuff, you make us sort of validate and sort of put the time and the money to keep on improving it, right? It's like, because we're not charging a membership, right? So if you want upgrades, it's like, buy the newer stuff so we can keep on making the upgrades, right? Mm-hmm. Or even the firmware stuff. Yeah,
it's good. It makes sense, but it is like,
I mean, I have 8 cold cards right now.
Yeah,
I think it's like kind of an issue. I kind of have a problem. And then I saw that you put epoxy on them now. Now I just want to get more.
That's right.
Yeah, serial hoarder over here, whether it's Bitcoin, cold cards, URLs, whatever it may be.
I love my hardware too, though.
It's fun to play these little devices. I mean, like, it's
so
kind of weird.
That's what I'm actually banking on, like, a collection of hardware making me some Satoshis in the future.
Yeah.
Like the 21 computer, original Trezor and stuff like that.
And I think, like, the most important security thing you could ever do is privacy.
Just don't talk about it.
No, or, like, even worse, like, don't ever connect, like, the device to anything that's connected to the internet, right? So, like, because, you know, if your hardware wallet vendor forces you to connect to their servers to activate the wallet, you're essentially saying, hey, this is my serial number. You know, I know you promised not to keep the information, but the information is out.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because, I mean, out of the 3 big hardware wallet vendors, you being one of them, you're the only guys that, like, the other hardware wallets work with other software, but you're the only guys who don't have your own software. You've just chosen to opt out of that situation
That's
in the
right.
first place, right? Like, if you're connecting through, like, a Ledger or a Trezor through their built-in software, their web wallet or Ledger Live now has, like, a separate app that they use, like, everything's getting sent to their servers.
No, it's privacy, bad privacy by default, which I don't subscribe to. It's terrible. You know, both those wallets can be used with like, say, Electrum or you know, now HWI. But if you have to activate the device, and most people are lazy, they're going to just use the web stuff anyways. It's like, kind of like, what's the point?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that was the main thing behind, like, making a device that doesn't need to be connected to a computer, right? Like, you just use the microSD. You can connect it, right?
If you wanted to, yeah.
Or especially maybe it's your warm wallet. You know, your warm wallet sits on your desk, it's connected, who cares, right? But for real hodling, like, you know, the stuff should be done cold, you know, because, again, there is no perfect solution. So you don't know if there is some radio, like, attack now, some side channel attack that's new and great and actually works, and it works remote. So the best thing you can do is just opt out.
So, I mean, on that tangent, one of the things I thought was really cool about the cold card is that you use the SD card as like a ferry. You're moving data back and forth between the computer, but there is a privacy risk there, right? Because you have this skeleton wallet that you're moving onto your computer, if someone gets access to that skeleton wallet, then they have all your addresses, all your past and future addresses, right?
Yeah, depends on how you set up, but yes. So,
and is that, that's unavoidable, right? Like, how do you avoid that?
No, So, because what you could do is you could have, you can have an air gap computer, right? Like a laptop that you sort of like drilled out the microphones and you did your proper sanitation of the laptop. And you have the laptop, have the actual wallet. So like you have Electrum on it, you have your full node on it or something. And on that laptop, you do the, you create the transactions, right? And then you sign it with a cold card and then you broadcast it on another computer.
Right. That's the best way to do it.
Exactly.
So it's not very user-friendly.
Exactly. And because if you are using your own node and you have, say, Electrum pointed to it, right, you're not broadcasting to anybody your addresses. So you have way more privacy that way. And then you can also use, say, Wasabi to anonymize your stuff. But yeah, again, it's one of those things, right? Like you have to pick your trade-offs. And I think like one thing that maybe is not talked enough is like fund segregation. Like, you know, create your cold pile one, cold pile two, your warm one, your warm two, you know, your hot, you know, and then do coin selection, right? Like select which UTXO you're going to use to send money out. And with those very basic things that, you know, those are available to pretty much any normal user as opposed to super complicated stuff, you already do a great job at privacy, right? Just not commingling stuff. Because, you know, a bad guy can only take away what he knows he can take away, right? If he doesn't know he exists, like, he can't take away.
Yeah, no, it's... Again, the nuance to all this is... I don't want to say perplexing, it's like, it's... daunting. It's very daunting, the nuance to it. And so do you see this nuance getting better over time, or do you think this is the price we have to pay for this?
Yeah, it's a little bit the price. You know, it's kind of like, buddy, you want to be your own bank? Toughen up.
Yeah.
You know, like I see Bitcoin as like Wells Fargo crossing U.S. with shotguns. You know, like it really is like that's being your own bank.
Yeah, being your own bank will never be the easiest.
No, you'll never be as easy. Like, there is a cost. And remember, right, like, there's all these institutions that started by offering services to keep your stuff safe. I mean, they kind of screw up through the years, but you know, this cost that you used to defer to somebody else now is on you, right? And education really is everything.
It's one of my thought experience. I guess, like, are people willing to learn? Will they be willing to learn? And I mean, we're at the BitBlock Boom conference, and Bitstein just went on a great tear about meme warfare, but like lowering time preference was part of it. And does Bitcoin fix everything? The fact, like, if you're thinking about Bitcoin and saving money for the future, then you're more inclined to learn about how to secure it, and then you just become smarter and by knowing how to use more stuff. Like, does Bitcoin fix everything? Does it create the incentive to learn more? I'm asking you.
You're asking me?
Yeah, I don't know.
It obviously doesn't literally fix everything, but it fixes a lot of things, and it helps set up a better mindset to life in general. And I mean, in terms of Bitcoin storage, like, the longer you're in Bitcoin, the more Bitcoin you hold, like, the more you have to learn. So you're compelled to learn. In terms of, like, simplicity, like really the path to go to as simple and as secure as possible is probably through the creation of solid hardware, right?
So the way I like to say it's like C passwords, right? Like for websites and things, it's still all crap, right? We still haven't even solved that problem. I mean, look at even YubiKey got owned and disastrous situation. So like
Bluetooth just got owned too.
This is I don't think this is a fully solvable problem. And I think that, you know, we are fortunate that we get to just do Bitcoin all day, so we get to also know all this stuff, right? But, like, you know, your average no-coiner goes and buys a few coins. Of course he's going to keep it on delete Coinbase or Cash App. And
shout out Cash App.
Yeah, no, it's and you kind of should initially. I think we can't like force, and we shouldn't force people to go to punch above their weight until they're ready, because you know their stuff depends on it, right? Like, I mean, if we keep on telling people to just do more complicated stuff without like getting them there, they're going to screw themselves out of their money.
That's why, like, shout to Corey Clipston coming out with Giving Bitcoin, where you give somebody Bitcoin, but for them to access it, they have to go through the process of learning what a private public key pair is, what a private key is, how to secure it, how to secure a seed phrase. And then once you've proved that you have at least a base knowledge, then you can get the UTXO sent to you.
Yeah, it's, and I think we'll get better. I think, like, because I don't think it's fixable, like fully fixable, but it doesn't mean it won't get much better.
Yeah, and the UX again, like the UX around it, like services like that, where it's like, all right, you want to hold Bitcoin, here's a beginner's guide to learning what you're going to need to know when you're custodying your own stuff.
I think the issue is like the incentives are not there for the UX stuff, like they really aren't. I mean, you know, you look at even Bitcoin Core.
Aren't they, though?
No.
You make it easier for people to hold Bitcoin, therefore...
The circular economy, yeah. Like, I agree, but because it's not directly related to the UX, I think the incentives are simply not there, because otherwise we would already have seen... It's been 10 years. We would be seeing, like, better, easier to use. And we see that on the custodial stuff, and on the closed source stuff, because then the incentive is there.
The business model isn't really
there,
right?
Exactly. There's no business model for you to keep a wallet. You know, right now, I mean, it's essentially like a lot of, you know, on the sort of like on the cold side, on the security side, on the consensus side, yes, the incentive is there for you to keep Bitcoin going, so your bag keeps on going too, right? But on the more user level, there really is no incentive for somebody to put all the time doing the UX, UI for some, you know, some security setup, because you know what, he's not gonna get paid. It's gonna be and you know what,
just
donation
gets forked or something.
Exactly, donationware has limits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, like, people wanna get paid, and they should. Like, I mean, you should make money out of the stuff you make.
No, I wholeheartedly agree, and that's like that's actually something I've been thinking a lot about lately, is like people trying to come to or not being able to come to grips that this is all open source software and you should be contributing to that open source effort, and by doing that you're sharing your work with the world, and again it can be forked and stuff like that. And I do think there's a mental block, not a mental block, but a lot of people are trying to monetize this stuff, and it's like, oh, you can open source it, and it's again, I just find like there's this like weird area we find ourselves in 10 years in, where people are trying to monetize the open source nature of it, and it's not easy. It's not possible. And how do you break?
I mean, look at
that.
The asymmetry, right? Even on CoinKite.com, you know, you had people like keeping millions worth of Bitcoin, right? And like paying us say $30 a month. It's like, and that was already on the higher account kind of stuff, and complaining. It's like, buddy, you're paying me $30 a month to do, you know, this. Now, if your institution, you go pay BitGo, and BitGo had to change their business model too. They charged a basis point or whatever on transactions, because there really is no other way.
Is that what their business model is now?
I think it is. I don't know. The last time I checked was probably a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I don't really pay attention to them.
I think they charge like percentage essentially.
The interesting one is, I would say, like the reverse of that is that both Wasabi and Samurai are kind of figuring out a way to take a profit off of the privacy aspect,
yeah.
Right? I mean, like Wasabi is probably user-friendly software wallet we've had, like the best UX. I mean, it still needs a long way to go, but like they're making a decent sized profit. Like you can track like how much they're making from the mixing services.
Yeah, but see, that's a value add service,
mm-hmm.
Right? That's not the wallet itself, right? So now you're just making that service subsidize the wallet.
Right.
But eventually, you know, maybe not. Maybe they would just keep on and go because it's fun. But the incentive for them is going to be to offer just a mixing service as it gets more complicated, more people, more support and all this stuff. Like, look at joint markets, right? You can make money on joint markets by just
being a maker.
Exactly. Right. Market making. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but there is no UI, there is nothing, right? That's the service right there. So, you know, it is tricky. Maybe on the phone is a little different with Samurai, for example, right? Because now the stuff is on the phone. So you need that wallet, that UI on the phone. So you force them to keep on improving the UI on the phone so that they can make their money from the mixing.
It's like a funnel into their, you know, they also, like, they sell a node and then they have the app and everything, and all of it funnels into their value add services.
Yep.
While the whole thing is still open source. And it's harder to fork out something like that because there's such a network effect in terms of liquidity and whatnot. Exactly. I mean, I feel like that's kind of got to be, to bring the most security and sovereignty to, like, the average person, like, you kind of need, like, a full stack of hardware and software where, like, they're, like, handheld kind of through the whole process.
Yeah, I think I still think I keep on trying to convince Adam back to just make a sort of setup a set-top box, you know, for the satellites. So, like, you know, you have this box.
That's what I want.
You know, like, it's like it has Ethernet on it. It's connected to the Internet. It also has a satellite in the roof. It has hard drive on it. It has, like, decent process. So it's essentially running a full node, taking the feed from the satellite for, like, extra checking or in case you lose the Internet. And then, like, that's your home node. Everybody has a home node.
It's connecting to the satellite.
You know, and then it's running maybe Electrum private server on it or something. And then you have your laptop that connects your own node. And you know it's self-validation, really. If you're not self-validating, you're not doing Bitcoin. and then, you know, like, you can use this laptop for you to do the signing, to create the PSBT transactions, right? But, like, this is a huge paradigm shift for the average consumer world to move into, right? It's going to take a long time.
Yeah. Oh, a very long time. And I'm happy you brought up the satellites because that's just, like, another interesting part of Bitcoin. It's like, hey, yeah, you can send transactions via the internet, which the layman probably doesn't even understand to begin with. And it's like, oh, yeah, you can actually send transactions via satellite as well. And this is something I love about you is that you're fascinated with ham radio, and you sent private keys via ham radio to Sam Patterson, correct?
Yeah, I sent to Sam. It was a private key. It was a three-word brain wallet.
Yeah.
But I did send the salt over a different channel, I think. I was going to, and then I didn't. Anyways, and then I sent, I think, Elaine a transaction for her to broadcast for me. And then we sent a lightning transaction too. It's kind of a weird, like, ham is, like, the most useless and most useful hobby you ever have.
How did you get into it?
Peter had a license. I used to, like,
your partner have, Peter.
Yeah, I used to have a boat license back in Brazil, and I had, like, you know, radios and stuff. I have always sort of been into radios. But I decided to actually get a license so I could do more interesting stuff. You know, it's an unfortunate place where most of the hams are, like, bootlickers.
Bootlickers?
Bootlickers, yeah.
Yeah.
They're very afraid of losing the spectrum, you know.
So what's the deal? You have to get a license to send messages on a certain frequency?
Yeah.
Okay.
And essentially, like, in most countries, hams are actually allocated a decent chunk of spectrum on pretty much every band, like, including bands for cell phones and all this. Like, we have bands in almost everything, all the way to, like, 10 gigahertz kind of thing. It's pretty crazy.
That's what it was crazy learning from Richard Myers, who's working on the mesh network. Why is it escaping me right now? It's just like
Go 10. Lot 49?
Yeah, Lot 49, Go 10, TX10. And that, conceptually, it's, like, crazy to think there's just, like, different frequencies of radio waves that are all around us at all times that you can connect to and send messages from. And how the hell does that become a license thing? You're talking about physics.
Yeah, well, so, like, you know, like, before there was, like, commercial, military, or state radio, it was actually, like, amateur people talking to each other, like Marconi kind of deal, right? And you can do a lot of damage with radio stuff, right? You have a lot of power. You could like stop flights, like
really?
Yeah, like you could jam flights, like the radio on all this stuff.
How would you do that? Would you jam just their communication tools?
Yeah, you can. You could totally do it. You know, they have very sophisticated tools to find you and then take you to jail. But you could cause like some damage, kind of like how people can nowadays drive a drone into an airplane, right? Like, mm-hmm. So that's sort of like where it came from, right? Like this idea that like, you know, at least we want to know the people doing this stuff. We want to make sure they're reasonably
good
trained.
Yeah.
No, but they're reasonably trained. Because you don't want somebody just pressing transmit, right? Like you want to make sure they know like not to encroach on this or on that kind of stuff. Not a huge fan personally of licensing systems, but this one is tricky because there is a lot of externality, right? But yeah, so I just, and then there's all the people who do like pirate radios and all kinds of stuff. Like radio is pretty cool. I recommend getting a license because you learn the actual tech. It's not like a stupid like test. Like you have to actually understand the stuff mm-hmm. to take the test. So and that process to study to the test, you actually learn the stuff.
Do you think it's a more efficient means of communication?
So the cool thing about radio is it doesn't matter which frequency you're in, you're sending stuff at the speed of light, right? And if you're talking on the lower bands that have lower bandwidth, they actually bounce on the ion sphere and you can get them to go across the earth, like very little power.
That's what Zabo and Elaine are working on, right?
I don't know if they're actually working on that, but no, that,
they
that
proposed
it's,
it?
It's not, none of the stuff is new to radio people. Let's put it this way. Like, it's like kind of new to Bitcoin.
Being able to send Bitcoin transactions.
Yeah, I mean, that's already possible. Like, that's what I did with Sam mm-hmm. Patterson, right? Yeah. Like, with Elaine, too. Essentially, we use lower bands and get them to bounce off the ion sphere and get to the other side because the earth is round, mm-hmm. right? So, if you send something.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I know.
Hey, right? Don't say controversial stuff on this podcast.
Oh, it's going to be great. We're going to get the flat earthers to hit on this.
I have a flat earther fan who's always in my inbox.
Whenever on the bent, whenever he says like around the globe or something like that, he always gets a response from the flat earther.
Oh, that's amazing. So like, so the radio waves won't go straight on the flat earth. So you have to get them to bounce back, right? And higher frequencies get absorbed. So they fade away.
Right,
but lower ones kind of come back.
The flat earth conspiracy has just been debunked. You can prove it with radio waves. Sorry, freaks. This is now a Bitcoin podcast. We're no longer a flat earth podcast.
Yeah, it'd be pretty weird how, like, the physics of a flat earth.
Yeah, like, what's...
Like, I mean, no, it's just, like, because gravity makes...
If you believe in
planet, and that's kind of roundy.
You should just skip flat earth and go straight to simulation. Like, if you believe in flat earth.
I'm okay. Like, you know, if you want to say we're in a simulation and the earth is flat, fine. I can accept that.
Yeah. We got off on a little bit of a tangent here. I guess what's exciting you right now in the hardware space and Bitcoin in particular?
So, I mean, we're pretty pumped about sort of working on the next version because I do want to close some of the trade-off loops there. We might make another block clock.
Ooh, let's talk about the block clock. How did you make that?
So Bitcoin was going to be 10 years old, right? And I wanted to make like a more artistic object that represented Bitcoin, right? It had to be like something that made a noise and sort of like very, very physical to sort of represent this thing that's completely not physical.
Yeah, almost analog, right?
Exactly, the analog of it. And, you know, we all care about the Bitcoin price, even though we say we don't. And I like seeing, to me at least, it's a very, like, zen thing to just look at Bitcoin happening. So, like, I like to see, like, how long since the last block and, like, in which block height we're in kind of thing. So, you know, this thing is just sitting, you know, in my office looking at me, you know, like sort of like cycling through, you know, Bitcoin information. So it gives me like the the block height, and then he also does the price, and you know, we put some sales on it for ourselves. You can put your own API on it, and it's like electromechanic digits. We actually sourced, so there's this one last company in the world that makes like professional digits. This guy's, it's a company in Poland that makes digits for train stations.
Yeah, basically it's like the old train station and airplane.
So I wanted to use the flippy ones,
right?
But I couldn't find the supplier that could make that in any affordable way, and nobody makes them anymore in mass quantity, right? So we settled for the seven digit electromechanic one, and those actually are still used in some places. They're rated for 250 million cycles, so it's gonna take a little while for them to wear off. And so yeah, it's just nice to have this thing clicking away in my office, you know. And we found like we did, of course, in our company aesthetics, you know, you can see the whole PCB says 10 years of Bitcoin on it. We found like this cool, like there's this framing shop that does frames for the art gallery, the main art gallery of Ontario. And we got them to make the frames, and we put plexi on it. And yeah, it's just nice object.
And it's not cheap.
No. It costs
you get
a lot
of shit for that.
When you first released it, I think it cost a Bitcoin.
That's
right?
True. That's true.
I remember seeing it. I was like, this is the most badass thing ever. And then I clicked the link, and I was like, nope.
You know, this is the problem with Bitcoiners, right? It's time preference and like fucking frugal crowd. It's amazing. We sold a few. Like, there's quite a few out there. And we're only making 500 of them forever.
Like, how many have you already made the 500? Or
no. We make them small batches.
How many are out already?
I don't know, 50, 100, something like that.
Hey freaks, go to tftc.io/contribute and give us a Bitcoin so we can buy a block clock. Thank you.
Well, now it's just half
a Bitcoin.
It gets cheaper every day.
Yeah. Exactly. It's just, unfortunately, that project, I can't really make it cheaper. Like, it's just cost a lot of money to make.
Yeah, it's a physical device.
It's just one of those, like, flex projects. You know, you're just, like, you're just flexing because you can. It's just cool.
Yeah, like, that's, yeah. You know, like, at some point, I need to turn off the utilitarian mind, you know? Like, it's like, I need, like, when
have
I make
fun.
Exactly, just make something fun, right?
Is this fun? Are you having fun? Are you more stressed out? Are you more...
I love it. See, I get stressed out if the price go up.
Yeah.
That's very uncomfortable.
Especially when it goes up
fast.
Because
then you have to think about it.
Yeah. Especially
I don't
want to
think about it.
Right.
I want to just, like, live. You know, like, and I mean, you know, I say to people, you know, like, it's cool and all to stack the sats all the time, but, like, don't forget to live your life.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you could get hit by a bus,
right?
You know, like, so, you know.
So what is living your life to you? What do you like to do outside of Bitcoin? Obviously, radio waves.
Backcountry canoe. I hunt. I shoot guns. I barbecue a lot. I shitpost. Is that Twitter? I guess. I don't know. I've been really enjoying learning economics. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, I have a baby, you know,
yeah.
Baby things.
You seem like you have it figured out. Your pictures when you're paddling in your canoe, it's like, damn, it seems very peaceful.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, like, I like keeping the business a little bit more, like, independent and stuff. Like, you know, it's nice to make more money. It's nice to do stuff. But, like, at some point, you have to think about, like, the cost benefit of making more money, too, because... oftentimes you can't have time and money at the same time, you know. And I don't know, I like to simplify the life a bit, you know, not like making minimalist home and shit like that, but just sort of like try to like not have things in life that complicate your life.
I can get down with that. And this is something we got on topic last night when we were closing down that bar. But let's talk a little bit about your move from Brazil to Canada, if you're comfortable with that.
Yeah, so when I was 19, yeah. So I was looking at, like, I had my shares of, like, different schools and things like that. And then I kind of finally got my, like, high school diploma. And then and I did college at night when I was 15.
Really?
Yeah, like school was not exactly working out for me. So I went and got an arts degree. I sort of like wanted to go sort of study somewhere else in the world after that. And I kind of came to, I don't know, for whatever reasons, multiple reasons, I ended up like going to Canada to do this college course there because it was interesting. And then I sort of fell in love with the city and decided to stay. The college course turned out to be crap, total crap. But I still needed the points to have enough points to apply for citizenship. Applied for citizenship and sort of like never left.
Do you ever think about going back to Brazil or?
No. I love Brazil, but like it's, I don't know. It's just like the way my brain works and the way the culture there works, just incompatible.
Doesn't mesh.
I like simple, uncomplicated.
So you feel like you found a home?
Yeah. Although, like, you know, the way the country's sort of going more, like, socialist and more, like, less freedom and stuff, it's very unsettling. So, like...
Where, Brazil or Canada?
Canada.
Yeah.
It's mostly a function. I mean, like, this is a country that's, like, an ex-colony that sort of had the umbilical cord for too long. So, like, you never be sort of like, you know, fuck you, we're getting out of this deal kind of deal, right? So... I don't know, but you know, I have family there now, my wife, my kid, so like I'm not moving. She won't move.
Yeah, it's moving's never fun. Moving is probably my least enjoyable activity in the world. I've moved many times in my life.
Oh man, moving houses is just like, it's like borderline insanity, like packing all the crap. And you know, I have lots of tools and the whole lab in the bed. It's just crazy. Just thinking about it, like, it stresses me out.
Yeah, it's not fun at all, even if you move, like, three blocks away. It's especially not fun if that's the case. But let's bring this back to Bitcoin. The gentleman sitting to my right here, Matt Odell, is running a cold card demo in a few weeks here in New York City. Do you have any advice for him?
Yeah, so I'm going to try to come out there. Say hi. I think it's like just empower people to sort of do the stuff themselves, you know, and like not, don't push complexity, really. It's like take people to the comfortable space.
Like one step at a time.
Exactly. You know, like let them play with Bitcoin without going full sort of tinfoil, right? You get there. Everybody gets there. It's just don't put them there.
It's like trying to find the right balance of tinfoil.
Exactly. Right. I mean, just make sure they don't get robbed.
There's a lot of people wanting to learn about cold cards. That thing sold out real quick.
There's like some people who say like you're doing it wrong if you're not using like cubes. Like it's impossible for like the average person to ever use fucking cubes. Like that's a ridiculous threshold to set. You know,
I just ignore like that kind of stuff because you know it's completely unrealistic. Like it's very easy to go, you know, on like Twitter and say, oh, you should do it that way. Make the product that work that way. I want to see it.
Right? No, it's almost like a weird humble brag from people when they're saying that shit.
It's like, yeah, I mean, it's great. Like,
people should do it if they can.
Yeah.
Great.
But the average person is never going to do that.
Unlikely. Yeah. It doesn't mean we shouldn't like teach people more exciting, sort of more complex stuff, but, you know, people have limitations and people also have other shit in their lives. I mean, we are just in Bitcoin all the time, right? Yeah. But like, you know, people have other stuff, you know, somebody has to like design airplanes, you know, they can't just shit post on Twitter all day about Bitcoin.
Well, we definitely need more airplane designers because they're fucking up pretty bad these days.
Exactly.
Dude, I think we were talking about this last night. I don't remember if we were talking about this exactly, but I think it was you, but the screens on the back of the seats, like I flew American here to Dallas and like you could tell like there was a cursor on the screen, you could tell there's like some shitty software in there and you're flying like 300 people through the air and like you can connect to that device with a USB and it's like it just seems like the most hackable thing and like the worst.
Oh yeah, no, I mean
the worst design
as
for
far as
ever.
I understand the entertainment system is fully separated.
It's supposed to be, right?
Exactly. But you never know, right? I mean, one guy there connects the wrong thing to the wrong thing, and then, like, yay, You know, you have full control of the airplane.
Yeah. Didn't somebody do that, though? Somebody used...
Yeah, I think so.
Somebody used one of those things just to, like, change, like, the temperature of the plane or something like that. Like, hacked into it.
You wouldn't surprise me if the cabin stuff, like, the entertainment system and other cabin sort of environmental stuff is, like, together.
Lighting and stuff like that.
Yeah, it probably is.
As long as, like, the flight control shit isn't, yeah, exactly. isn't connected to it.
No, and it's kind of crazy, right? Because, like, planes now are so, like, complex and the airspace is so busy and stuff that, like, you know, you really can't have humans flying planes anymore. I mean, a human doesn't fly a plane anymore. It's all automated, like, for, like, quite some time. They have the pilots there, I guess, just to make everybody feel great.
Just take off and land?
And then, look, I mean, you know, when the MAX had the issue, you know, like, the reality is, you know, the airlines chipping out on the education of the pilots or didn't buy the extra safety feature or whatever. And as soon as the pilot stick his greasy fingers on the thing, it just poof.
No, it's flying. Whenever I get on a flight, I just submit myself to the fact that I may die, you know?
This could be the one. And there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, exactly. You just got to submit yourself to
planes are fucking safe. Like, it's like crazy safe.
Yeah.
Like, when you look at the statistic of this stuff.
Compared to,
like,
cars and trains.
It's insanely safe. Like, it's
sorry for fear-mongering, freaks.
No, but I mean, it's one of the few situations in our life where you don't have
control.
You have, like, zero control. So even though it is extremely safe, it's by the odds, it's like you're in someone else's hands. You're completely letting yourself into someone else's hands.
If you think that's bad, see, I don't think enough people put, like thinking into being in the highway. Like, you're going at, you know, like 100 kilometers an hour, 60, right, in American.
I drive too fast.
You know, of course, more for some people, but, you know, whatever. And, like, every imbecile who is, like, who you consider an imbecile is driving at the same speed as you.
It's crazy.
Very near you.
No, then I just think about how angry I get in a car, and then, like, I'm a very – I do not like traffic or – other drivers.
You're literally trusting everybody else. Yeah,
it's the most ridiculous. Like, if you think about it, like, now, it's the most ridiculous mode of transportation. Like, let's just have all these people
in
just trust them, yeah, driving one ton, yeah, vehicles around. Yeah, and just hope that they don't fuck. And if one person fucks it up, it's not even that it's dangerous. You could just have traffic for hours. Well,
isn't,
you know,
traffic accidents, like, the highest killing, like, thing that there is for humans? It's like, it's essentially like, like, people concerned about guns and things like that. It's like, no, cars kill.
Yeah, cars kill more people, and then people are concerned trolling about self-driving cars. They're like, oh, we can't go to a full self-driving car system because so many organ donations come from car accidents that we
yeah
we
but need drunk to Uncle Joe can, right? Like, it's like
I hope we get to an autonomous self-driving car future.
I think it won't
you can
happen
do it for planes you gotta
for a long time. It's just like, just think about, like, you know, how, like, legislation for that stuff works. But I think we will see delivery. I think delivery will move into, like,
autonomous
for sure.
Yeah.
Like, that to me is, like, where it's going to go. And not even for the semi-trucks on the highway and stuff like that. I'm talking about, like,
drones.
Amazon.
Yeah.
Like, Amazon is going to just, and it's going to be like a small little car, and it's going to beep, and you go outside and take it out of the thing, and
I see, like, Uber could be, like, a pretty big stepping stone, especially if you have certain lanes and stuff that are just only autonomous, because then everything gets a lot of the issues and the drawbacks get taken care of if all of the vehicles in that.
It's going
to
be tricky in, like, cities that are dense and stuff. Like, but, you know, rural deliveries and things like that, I mean, it's pretty simple, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know who it was. It was either FedEx or UPS, but, like, 2 days ago they came out and they've been... They've been discreetly testing in Arizona autonomous delivery vehicles, and it's supposedly been going really well.
It's like kind of like green energies in a way. It's like it's very hard to tell when it's just a marketing exercise, or
right.
You know, I guess like every time it's like if it has a PR angle to it, it's like, you know, that's probably not even the model that the engineers are working on. That's the one that fits bigger sticker.
Yeah, true.
So many problems to solve here, gentlemen.
I know. Bitcoin solves everything.
Right? Lower that time preference.
car accidents may be the one thing Bitcoin can't solve.
No, Bitcoin can solve that.
How?
You could take like Bitcoin security deposits, and you could take their Bitcoin if they get into a car accident. Or
there you go.
Like
people drive.
You have
safer.
A bond. You want to drive a car, you have a bond.
If you get in an accident, the person that you hit automatically gets the Bitcoin connected
there you
to
go.
Your car.
Oh, that problem solved. See, Bitcoin solves everything.
I want to pay people in Bitcoin to move out of my way when there's traffic.
Why not?
That
right?
Would be badass.
I mean, that would be like amazing. Like just creating an economy on the highway like that.
Could you imagine the bidding that would go on for that? That would be expensive. Yeah, that would get like blade level expensive at some point.
But see, if you're a Bitcoiner, you don't have a problem. You don't want to get anywhere because of the amount of fucking good episodes on podcast that you're gonna hear on your car. So like seriously. It's like this thing is eating my life. So like, you know, you're gonna sit in the car and you're gonna earn sats to listen to podcasts and get out of the way of other people.
Maybe that is the solution. Maybe people are better,
that's
more patient drivers.
That's the Uber of the future. You just go by yourself and like, hey, I'm gonna hold up traffic and you assholes have to pay me to move.
Yeah, I mean the car is the best place to listen to podcasts and audiobooks. It's amazing.
I need to upgrade my car because I'm still riding on analog radio.
No, but it's I actually like when I listen to podcasts in the car, I like having one earbud in.
Yeah.
I think it's a better experience than have it come through the speakers.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, the speakers suck at voice. I mean,
yeah,
unless
they're
you have
good
a
for music.
Unless you have like a fancy car stereo, like the speakers are not great for voice.
It's interesting. Never knew that.
Yeah, because I've been commuting by car a lot more lately, and that's how I always do my podcast. It's always one earbud in my ear.
Does it make the drive go faster?
And you're more patient. You're enjoying the drive more. You know, I think you're probably a better driver when you're listening to a nice Bitcoin podcast,
or when you're tweeting. No, I'm joking.
Don't tweet and drive, people.
Please do not tweet and drive. That's actually one thing that really pisses me off when I see people texting, like on the road, and you're going 80 miles an hour. It's like, please stop.
So yeah, when are you guys coming to visit Canada?
I was there a few weeks ago.
Really?
In Montreal.
Montreal.
I do need to get to Toronto. That was my first time in Canada.
Come by Toronto. Let's go have steak.
I would love to.
Let's
all the Bitcoiners come by. We go for
maybe
steak.
We should do a Toronto live show.
I'd be down.
There you go.
I think we can get some people to go to that.
How's the Bitcoin community in Toronto?
So Toronto had a very old Bitcoin community there. A lot of Bitcoiners there. And then Ethereum happened.
Yeah, they're all shitcoiners.
Didn't Anthony DiOrio buy like the tallest building or something like that?
I think he bought a penthouse. So like the early Ethereum people really made it like good chunk of cash. So we used to have a Bitcoin dev meetup in Toronto like back before Ethereum existed. I think it's like very early days. And then we started getting shitcoiners coming in to try to peddle their stuff. And then we just stopped it.
That's why everybody needs to adopt the BitDev's model of Bitcoin meetups and just have no mercy for shitcoinery.
No, because our meetups were kind of like not very... So the way we ran it was I'd buy a few cases of beer, put it on the room, and then people come. And then we ask if anybody had a project they wanted to show, they could show the project. And then we would essentially just sort of like have like people just in kind of like standing circles sort of talking about stuff and arguing about Bitcoin stuff or economics. So it was a very easy to get infected by shitcoiners trying to push their crap because we were not controlling who's coming or that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's hard.
Well, the way BitDevs does it is it's like Socratic style.
Yeah.
So like if someone asks a question that's obviously shitcoin focused, then they get ostracized.
Right.
And also what I like about BitDevs is they also have beer, which is great. It's like a nice, relaxing environment. Yeah. And they have no photos. I think it's super underrated that I think, you know,
somebody pulls out their phone and take a picture of BitDevs, they get scolded.
I want to have a Bitcoin conference that there's no photos.
Oh, Bitcoin, Bitcoin is like that.
Really?
Yeah, you can't take, unless you have permission from the person. Like, you can't take crowd photos or things like that.
I think that should be more common, because I always feel self-conscious when I'm at these conferences, and then I keep getting hit on camera and stuff like that.
Yeah, some woman was just taking, like, a
I just tweeted a picture of you.
There you go, exactly.
Kidding.
Rodolfo's part of the problem.
We're all part of the problem.
You know, I mean, the privacy stuff, unfortunately, I didn't think Bitcoin was going to happen this much. So I kind of, like, doxed myself in the early days and sort of...
You're going to have to shave your beard.
Yeah.
It's always the bear markets.
You know, all the podcasts use the, like, picture of me from, like, I don't know, like, 10 years ago. They're like, I'm, like, looking like a decent person. It's kind of weird.
Hey, don't sell yourself short. You look pretty decent right now.
I know.
Good
but like,
sec.
Yeah. So I guess it's kind of good. Yes, please keep on using that picture. And I'll slowly get older and have a bigger beard.
Speaking of beards, mine's growing here. We've been here for almost an hour and a half, gentlemen. Is there anything else that you want to touch on in particular, Matt?
I mean, I'm ready to eat some lunch.
Yeah, so I'm pretty hungry.
I'd be down to wrap
too.
It up.
We're all hungover and hangry.
Yes, that's...
Do you have a parting note you want
actually,
to leave
for the freaks? Actually, you know what? Am I doing fasting today? Maybe. Maybe I'll wait for dinner.
We'll see. Do you have a parting note for the freaks out there? Anything you want to say? Anything you want to shill? Anything? Any wisdom you want to impart?
No, I mean, like... You know, you guys do a great job podcasting, and I think it's I don't think it's underappreciated anymore, but I think education is like a huge, huge part of developing a new system. And like podcasts that sort of like take the time and sort of like introduce the concepts and things to people are great. And it's nice that a lot of the podcasters have a lot of integrity and don't bring shitcoiners or like things that validate or could be perceived as validation. So like, you know, like thanks for educating people.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That was an unexpected compliment, and thank you for building stuff that we can actually talk about on this podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. And also on that note, we do, if you go to our YouTube channel, we have a Wasabi plus Cold Card
demonstration.
That video was great. That video was fantastic. I mean, keep on making those videos, because every time somebody asks the same question for the 100th time, I just normally send them a link to our TFM, and then I send a link to one of the videos that somebody made that's good for the topic.
Yeah, it's actually on the horizon for TFDC, more quote-unquote evergreen content that we can point people to.
Guides and videos and written guides and classes and courses and just all the above.
And, you know, whenever you guys need hardware, just let us know. You know, if you're making educational material for us, you get free hardware. I mean, like, and we might have, like a pseudo-affiliate thing where we might be able to at least, like, give educators or something, like, some money back for sending people our way or something. I feel like people need to get paid.
Yeah,
I
mean,
I want a Cold Card membership so that they just get new hardware gets shipped to my house.
You know, that's not a bad idea.
Maybe we're gonna work out on that.
I
would pay up front every year for that.
That's really not a bad idea. And you know, we can send like some of the other stuff we make and maybe the micro SDs and all that. Yeah,
it's a nice incentive alignment.
Yeah, no, I like that. And then we have like some like expectation too of like what kind of revenue we're gonna get, so it's a lot easier to plan that way. Because hardware is like totally upfront, right? You have to literally pay for production. You have to buy the parts, some parts like 6 months in advance, before you even manufacturing, to then put it for sale. It's very upfront capital heavy.
Yeah, that's a very extended timeline too. Yeah. It seems. Yeah. Well, thank you for building all the dope shit that you have and will continue to build.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for sitting down. This is
I don't think we can stand up hangovers we are.
This was awesome. I had such a good I was looking forward to this conversation. It's great to finally meet you too.
I know, right? It's like finally meeting in person is great.
And you're just as hilarious and awesome in person as I expected. Peace and love, freaks.
Stay humble, stack sets.